Felix Draeseke was a forward-looking German composer of the Romantic era, born 1835, died in 1913. He became interested in the efforts of innovative instrument builders of the 19th century who believed that the traditional string choir of Western music, comprised of violins, violas, cellos, and double basses, could be augmented and improved upon. Draeseke wrote at least three pieces for the new instruments that these inventors came up with, and two of those works were performed right here in Houston on the authentic and now extinct instruments for which they were composed at the annual conference of the American Musicological Society, which was held last November at the downtown Hyatt Hotel. The musicians who performed for the scholars gathered here at the... Not only did they perform for the scholars that were gathered at the convention, but they also came here to the studios of Houston Public Radio. I knew I had to get it out eventually. And recorded for us the pieces so that we could broadcast them on the front row. Today and next Monday, we'll hear these unknown works by a forgotten composer, played on instruments that only had a brief and not particularly widespread period of favor. Dr. Alan Kruak, musicologist from the faculty of California University, not the one in California, but the one in Western Pennsylvania, is the English language representative of the International Draeseke Society of North America, an expert on the composer and his music, and the person who arranged for Draeseke's works to be presented here in Houston. He talked with our man, Bob Stevenson.
Let's talk about Draeseke and his music. A contemporary of Brahms and Bruch, but a gentleman whose name and music have kind of been lost in history.
Yes, there have been quite a number of reasons why names get lost in music history, and certainly would apply to the story of Felix Draeseke. Initially, when he was a young man and associated with Franz Liszt in Weimar and also with Richard Wagner, whom he visited on quite a number of occasions, he was looked upon as probably the star of the younger group of New Germans, of the New German School at that time. And he made what he himself later said was a serious mistake. He moved to Switzerland in 1862, and he stayed there until 1876, 14 years of a lost career as far as he was concerned. And I think one of the reasons it may probably have been extremely lost is that he settled in the Suisse Romande, which was the French-speaking part of Switzerland, and that was considerably off the beaten path of what we call mainstream developments in music.
Took him out of the loop of what was happening in mainstream European music. Okay.
And then he went back to Germany, and he settled in Dresden. He went to he stayed there until the end of his life, and that's where he had most of his career. By the time he got there, he was a little bit older than what you would call an up-and-coming star, although he had already made a tremendous impact on people like Liszt and gained the admiration of, say, a man like Richard Wagner, and very, very much highly respected in his day. His friend Hans von Bülow once told him, and I think this has been borne out in the course of history, Felix, you are a harte Nuss, you're a tough nut to crack. And he even said to Draeseke, you know, I know what to admire in your music, but the general public will take a long time to come to it. And that has been one of the stumbling blocks.
So the music of Draeseke, let's try to characterize it a bit. There was this dichotomy. There were these two camps of music in 19th century Germany.
Yeah.
There was the Brahms school, who were sort of the conservative, looking back to the past, neoclassicists.
Mm-hmm.
You've identified Draeseke as being aligned with the progressives, Liszt and Wagner.
Initially,
okay.
Yes. And then when he goes back to Dresden, the work that he brings back with him is his wonderful Second Symphony, and he wrote to quite a number of friends at the time, this was his return to classicism.
Ah.
Well, return to classicism can mean a number of things, but essentially he was thinking of the basic expressive mode of the late Beethoven and the late Haydn and Mozart with the new harmonic spectrum that he had picked up from the New Germans. Mm-hmm. And he was also going to continue using the so-called unity and diversity ideal of the romantic approach to symphonic form. That you see clearly in the Symphonia Tragica, which comes a few years later. It's already there in the second and also first symphonies. But when he comes back...
The tragic.
Troika is the third.
Troika is the third. Yeah. That's right. Yes. But anyhow, getting back to his return to Germany, he certainly is well known, and he turns out quite a number of major works between 1876 and 1906. Then, for various reasons, he's getting old, the production slows down, but still a very high quality. The Tragica is written in 1884, and I believe it's premiered in 1886, and it did make quite an impact on the musicians of the time. But it's exactly at that period where suddenly Brahms is there with his symphonies, Bruckner is being discovered, and everything is pushed eastward towards Vienna, forget central Germany.
So there are these qualities of innovation, of newness.
Oh, yeah. I have to admit,
associated with his his alignment with the progressive movement in German music.
I have to perhaps his earlier works, you find some of the more innovative things somewhat self-willed. The Great Piano Sonata has moments where you say, did he really mean this harmonic passage? Liszt was overwhelmed by the Piano Sonata, this early Piano Sonata, Opus 6. And we now have, I think, there are three commercial recordings of it. And when you listen to it at first, I was not impressed. I have to admit, as an admirer, my goodness, after about three listenings, and you just hear, well, so-and-so is responsible for that. Didn't so-and-so get credit for that in music history? And you have these wild excursions into distant tonalities, almost sometimes atonal, not that I think is altogether a wonderful quality to have, but it goes in that direction of this breakdown of tonality. Now, he becomes a little less radical in his harmony as he smooths out with his second symphony, with the so-called his return to classical approach. But then you go through his works, and you can see that he never gave up his harmonic experimentation.
So there is that tough nut to crack
there
quality.
It
takes more than one hearing to.
But I must say, the tough nut to crack, a lot of people don't use the appropriate nutcracker. They want to hear Brahms or Bruckner or Wagner, and you can't do that. That gets in the way. If you let the music speak for itself, no matter if you don't initially understand it, you just have to give it a chance. And then you have the doubters say, yeah, I hear that about everybody. And they just don't do the extra chance.
So perhaps as a sort of adjunct to Dreyseke's interest in innovation and new developments in music, he got interested in the activities of some instrument builders.
That's right.
In late 19th century Germany, who decided that the string choir of the orchestra needed some expansion.
Exactly. They had, first of all, the model of Wagner, amplifying the sound of the brass. And there was this young man, I believe he was reasonably young when he started this, Hermann Ritter, who was not happy with the viola of the times. He claimed that oftentimes the viola had a nasal quality which interfered with the blending of the rest of the strings. As a matter of fact, he also picked up on a debate that had been going on for at least a century and a half about the viola. Does it really fill the gap between the tenor and the bass? And if you notice in the French scores, it's called the alto. And a lot of people thought, no, it's more between the violin and, or I should say the soprano and the alto rather than the tenor and the bass. I mean, for a lot of people, that's, splitting hairs. But to a musician, and especially to a composer, timbre, color is very important. Well, Hermann Ritter devised it's a slightly larger viola called the viola alta. And alto is simply the indication of an amplification of sound.
It's not that it's higher in pitch.
No. It takes in the general range of the ordinary viola, but it has a smoother sound and everything like that. And Richard Wagner, he took it to Richard Wagner, and Wagner was so impressed with it, he said, this is the viola I want for the Bayreuth Orchestra.
Oh.
And after Wagner's death, I'm sure that people like Engelbert Humperdinck and his own son Siegfried did have viola altas in the Bayreuth Orchestra. Now, Hermann Ritter lived into the 1920s, I forget the exact year of his death, but when you get to the end of the Second World War, the viola alta has practically disappeared, mainly because of what's developing outside of occupied Europe in those years. You have innovations in England and in the United States, from what I understand. And viola altas, although they're not so terribly difficult to find today, you do have to look for them. There is a young man, an American, as a matter of fact.
Are they still being made?
Well, that's what I'm coming to. There's a young man by the name of Carl Smith, who is a wonderful violist and has a position in the orchestra of the Graz Opera in Austria, and became very interested in the viola alta. And this past summer at the German meeting of the International Dresdica Society in Leipzig, he came up and gave a performance of this viola alta sonata that I have on the program today with his newly made and his newly constructed, according to the Ritter plans, viola alta. Well, it was a knockout. People who weren't expecting much difference, there is a difference, a much rounder, fuller, let's say bulkier sound, if you will. And when you hit chords with this viola alta, you can hear the viola on its own. I'm not sure that some composers wanted that, but evidently impressed Wagner enough that he liked the sound.
But at the same time, it also blends with the others, with the violin and the cello.
That's right.
Does away with that nasal quality the 19th century violas were guilty of.
Absolutely. And in the little blurb that we passed out at the concert of when the viola alta sonata was performed, and I do believe I have a copy there, Dresig in his still unpublished, Lebenserinnerung, in his memoirs, boldly states, "I would not have written either of these viola sonatas if it hadn't been for the viola alta. I am not interested in the sound of the ordinary viola." Huh. It was as simple as that.
Okay, and the piece itself.
Oh,
what do
gorgeous.
We hear when?
Oh, gorgeous. That's all I can say.
In this piece,
I should say, just sit back and listen. You will probably find yourself, what is he doing? Saying to yourself, what is he doing here? Because of that strange and very unique sense of harmony that he has. This is the first thing that people begin to perk up on, either both positively and negatively. But as you get accustomed to it, you just love it and you want more and more of it. And the finale, first of all, the first movement starts out with an utterly disarming but so beautiful theme. Just as simple as can be, within five measures, the harmony is so, I won't say strange that you won't like it, but just strange. You don't expect the melody to be taken in this direction, and this is true of the other motives as well. And of course, there are moments in the finale. There's a wonderful lyrical melody in the finale. I mean, quite frankly, my heart just melts every time it plays it. And the performer today, Jim Bogzowski, is an absolute marvelous interpreter. He brought out every nuance of emotion that you can possibly think of.
Dr. Alan Kruak, musicologist and the North American English language representative of the International Dresdica Society, talking with Bob Stevenson about 19th century German composer Felix Dresdica and his music for the new instruments being developed by inventors of his day. When that interview was recorded last November, Dr. Kruak was 50% of the music faculty at California University in western Pennsylvania. He is now with the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia.